Now, having said this, Lady Jackson, I'm proud indeed to introduce you to this Midland audience.
Mrs. Smaby, Mr. President, Mr. Mayor, friends of Midland assembled here. I'm really rendered rather speechless by what Mrs. Smaby has just said, but don't worry, I'm never speechless for very long, so I... But if I might diverge for one moment from the great hunger, or rather to deal with it from the point of view of the other kind of hunger, the desire for participation, I would like to suggest that what, above all, most women want in the Western world are two things: a little more domestic support and a little more opportunity of re-entering the educational system of the country when their children begin to grow up. And the reason I think why you find rather more participation by women in Eastern Europe and even in Russia is because these kind of needs are more understood socially. Do not get me wrong, I am not a raging communist. In fact, I have Soviet in-laws who come and visit us and say they are simply shocked at the laxity of family life in the Western world. But the idea of giving some assistance to women so that these other responsibilities can be taken on is perhaps one of the social problems of our country. I often think, what would happen to the business world if every single secretary vanished? Women have no secretaries. They need a little help. But that, I say, is one of the subjects which comes under another hunger, and perhaps we can talk about it another time, though certainly it does come within cooperative interests. So, dear Mrs. Maybe, I think that there would be a speech to make on that, but perhaps I can make it on another occasion. And what I'd like to talk about tonight is, of course, perhaps the prime challenge facing the human species, because although it's true that man does not live by bread alone, it's where he starts. And we have before us, within a certain span of time, the perfect possibility of confronting a great hunger which would make the 1840s look regional, small, and unimportant. In other words, we are now galloping on towards a situation in which, in large parts of the world, food supplies would have been decisively outstripped by the growth of population. This cannot be denied. It is simply there, built into the facts. Let's take 1980 or 1984, if you like, a nice ominous year. If we take the 1980s, the population of this planet will have gone up from 3 to 5 billion. That is already, as it were, built into the number of mums already present. There's nothing much we can do about that. And therefore, we have, if we're going also to take into account the very large deficiencies of diet which face two-thirds of the world's peoples now, we ought to envisage a doubling of our rate of food production by the 1980s. These are things which we cannot, in fact, change because they are already part of the picture. Now, what are our chances of getting this doubling? What are the chances, in fact, of meeting that target? And in one sense, one can say straight away they're extremely good, because one of the extraordinary results of a process which began with a land grant college and with the Homestead Act, which went on through all the varieties of stimulus and of support for American agriculture, and above all, the critical support of sustained and directed research. The fact remains that agriculture is about the most productive industry in the world, and one in which the gains in productivity have been most fantastic. At the moment, the possibilities, therefore, in sheer technical terms, of getting this doubling are perfectly good. If we were going to rely simply upon our developed agriculture, we could get this kind of increase, and we could envisage by 1980 a complete fill-in, if you like, of the gap which is likely in the developing world between demand and supply, which may be of the order each year of 55 to 60 million tons of grain, we could get that out of Western farming. We could probably get it out of American farming alone. We could probably get it out of half America's farms. At the moment, the surplus possible in the United States is being held back. And who knows what is being invented at the moment or what is actually germinating in the fertile mind of the American farmer. Every time, in fact, you tell him to reduce his acreage, he puts on something new and produces double the amount on half the land. This has been classic, and you will continue to do so. And you represent in this room one of the last best hopes of mankind, which is the certainty that mankind, if he puts his mind to it, can in fact feed himself. And therefore, from an a priori point of view, there really is no reason for pessimism. Because here in agriculture is one of the most productive and the most promising sectors of human activity. And if we were merely looking at the gap from the point of view of technique, it could be filled. And it could be filled, in fact, on the basis of the expected population growth. And I think I should inject here that in this context, the question of population control, of family planning, though essential in the longer period, is not relevant now for the reason I've already given. The mums are already in place. The mothers are there. The fertility rates are not going to change so startlingly by 1980 as to make much difference. What is more, a part of this increase will be for lengthening of life. In other words, we're going to have our 5 to 6 billion people to deal with in this century, whatever happens, and whatever our policies or family planning may be. And I'll come back to that in a minute. Now, the problem, of course, is, as we very well know, is that the food increase is not, in fact, going to happen among the peoples where the need is greatest and where the population is increasing most. At the moment, the rate of increase in the among the developing continents of the world is, in fact, no more than just barely keeping pace with the growth of population. There is no margin to improve the diet, and what is more, in critical areas such as the subcontinent, India and Pakistan, a large part of the increase of the last 15 years has been brought about, in fact, by more extensive farming. And in these countries, the very limit of arable land has now been reached. One forgets that India and China, the great countries of the Orient, were overpopulated, or at least very heavily populated, 2,000 years ago. We forget very easily that in 1789, in America, there were 5 million people at the outside for a whole continent that was virtually empty. At that time, there were already 150 million people in India, and probably over 250 million people in China. The statistics then were as irregular as the statistics now. They even then jumped about a bit, shall we say. But the thing is that Asia was very heavily populated before the modern revolution of technology and scientifically directed agriculture began. And therefore, we are not dealing in a large part of Asia with land supplies that can be mobilized. Now, it's true that in large parts of Africa, in parts of Latin America, there is spare land to be developed, but at only at very great cost of clearing, opening up, and of general development. So I think you can say that as a broad generalization, in the developing world, you cannot get this doubling, you cannot get this jump, unless you envisage a very large capital program in order to shift from extensive to intensive agriculture, or else to put in the monumental preparations which would be needed, for instance, if you took the whole of the eastern Andes and made them into a fertile area for farming, which could be done, but at enormous cost. Well then, you may say, fine, let's fill in the balance. Let's say that over the next 20 years, next 30 years, we will rely on massive exports to the developing peoples. And this is where we really begin to meet the crunch. And this is for a number of reasons. First, although it would be conceivable to fill in the gap with an annual export, with what would the developing peoples pay for this? Can we conceive that 12 years from now, concessionary exports would be 4 to 5 to 6 times more than now? What is more, conceive that this was the correct way of dealing with a crisis, because in fact, it would be giving people not the means to help themselves, which your president so underlined so justly. It would in fact be still a process of putting food in without changing the local agriculture. Now this has another grave disadvantage, and it's this, that you cannot in fact get people to the level where they can consume the food they need for their health if they are not themselves becoming productive people. They will not have the purchasing power. They will not have it internationally because of the extreme difficulties of world trade, which we've hardly time to go into, but broadly speaking, one can say that the bias in world trade is very much in favor of the developed nations and not, in fact, biased towards the developing nations. They have, therefore, the greatest possible difficulty in earning the foreign exchange they would need for these massive imports. But domestically, which is a point I think is sometimes forgotten, and that is that unless people's productivity is rising, unless they are, in fact, getting into the modernized agriculture and the modernized economy in general, they simply don't have the purchasing power to secure the food, which can only begin to be grown in the sufficient proportions if you get into the market economy. If people stay poor, they stay in the subsistence economy. If you stay in the subsistence economy, you cannot produce enough food. Therefore, what we are, in fact, dealing with here is the fundamental problem of development for the two-thirds of humanity who have not yet entered the technological economy. These are the people who, on their present methods, cannot feed themselves, and who, if we feed on a concessionary basis, will never learn to feed themselves. And therefore, we have to ask ourselves, what are the prospects over the next 12 to 15 to 20 years of getting that process of modernization in the agricultural system, in which the United States was the forerunner, in which Europe is now catching up in many ways, and in which the farmer himself, by becoming more productive, becomes one of the key factors in the total transformation of the economy. Because I would say in brackets here that one of the points that has been most clearly realized in development theory over the last 15 years is to see in a quite new way that no society which neglects its agriculture can flourish, and that agricultural modernization is the Janus head with industry of development. And without those two processes going together, you do not get modernization. Now, what are the prospects of modernization? And I'm delighted that your president had this experience of India. Because if you look again at the possibilities, the technical possibilities facing world agriculture, one can only rejoice. Because as a result of the very, very important research work done over the last 15 years in the adaptation of advanced plant breeding to the local conditions of monsoon and tropical agriculture, we are on the verge of a very significant world agricultural revolution. I used to say when my husband and I were out in India in the 1950s, oh, you're neglecting agriculture. You ought to put more of your capital into agriculture. And maybe we were right. Maybe more could have been done. But I now have a horrifying, at the same time, a very scarifying and humiliating vision of what would have happened if, in the 1950s, the Indians had put their money massively into agriculture and got nothing much more than a 2 to 3% increase in crops. Well, by waiting another 10 years, which was inadvertent, because I don't know that they did it consciously, certainly they didn't, they may now be able to get a 6 to 10-fold multiplication for the same capital, because in those 10 years, the adaptation, the Mexican hybrids of Taichung paddy, of all these various changes in plant species, make possible a breakthrough of a quite new kind. In other words, the possibilities as this decade draws to an end and the 70s begins, the possibility of high returns from agriculture is 6 to 10 times better than it was 10 years ago. And this should make us feel this extraordinary sense of hope about the future, which I often think is so terribly lacking at the moment when we look ahead. In the field of agriculture, thanks to pioneers in your own country, thanks to the research done by the Rockefeller Foundation, thanks to extraordinary efforts of adaptation made in India by the Indians themselves, the possibilities now of agricultural growth are very high indeed. Dr. Athwal, who's one of the geneticists who's been working in the Punjab, has been responsible for the acclimatization of a number of grain crops, which are being tried out now in various parts of India and are producing a 6 to 10 time multiplication of yields. And in the middle of this of the Bihar famine, a notice about the Bihar famine is that it didn't happen. The moment it became clear, incidentally, it wasn't going to happen, all the pressmen went home, because the only news would have been 3 million people dead. But the fact that 3 million people should have died and didn't cease to be news. This is one of the problems we deal with. But the Bihar famine, which, on the analogy of the 1940s, would have produced a major, major disaster, was in fact held at bay in part by the ability of this country and of Europe to contribute directly in grain support, but also because in several parts of Bihar, the breakthrough to irrigation and the breakthrough with new seeds was one factor in producing higher harvests in the middle of a so-called famine. And another thing which underlay this was the discovery, which is another one of the great discoveries, and we have every reason to feel optimistic, that possibly underlying the Gangetic Plain, and this is again what your president was talking to Mrs. Gandhi about, it's possible that under the Gangetic Plain, there are some of the largest reserves of sweet water in the world. The seepage from the Himalayas over thousands of years has in fact probably built up a potential basin under the Gangetic Plain, which, with the right kind of power systems and the introduction of tube wells, is one of the factors in potential agricultural change of simply revolutionary proportions. Now, there are other aspects of the agricultural revolution that one might mention. If one wants to look at the opportunities, let me give you one more, which is so startling that I am surprised indeed that it's not better known. 15 years ago, Kenya was the scene of one of the most savage and bloody turmoils in Africa's history, the Mau Mau. And the Mau Mau revolt, the Mau Mau rebellion, had at its roots the Kikuyu hunger for land, the feeling that they had been dispossessed by the incoming European settler. Now, what happened? As Kenya moved towards independence, some of the great gestures of understanding, conciliation, and generosity were made, and which the largest was undoubtedly the readiness of the British government, with the help of the World Bank, to buy out one-third of the European farmers at a sane market value and to settle on the land the Kikuyu farmers, who were the spearhead, as it were, of discontent. Now, what happened? This scheme, this land settlement scheme, was done with extraordinary care and skill. Before the farmers were settled on the land, all the drainage systems and the farm-to-market roads were put in advance. The size of the holdings was based upon an income concept of £150 plus subsistence. And on the land was put cows in milk, and a certain percentage of the land was already ploughed to a cash crop, pyrethrum in this case. And the result was that the farmer had an income from the day he took possession of his land, and having an income could begin the transfer costs of getting his freehold over 25 years. What's been the result? Well, I hope that on one of the trips of your officers they will go to Kenya, where indeed I believe you have sent cooperators to assist in the training of the new Kikuyu farmer. I've been there two or three times, and to go over those areas where only 15 years ago all was blood and darkness, and to see the new shining fields is one of the great human experiences. And indeed, it has even its humorous side, because in the old days, the Kikuyu messages, which, you know, kill X, spavin Y, kill so many cows, was carried in these sticks, and they were ominously set up in the corner of the forest. Well, through those same areas now, through the tidy little cactus hedges, you can see these same sticks stuck up with a message on them, but the message says, cow on heat, send the insemination van. And that, I think, is 15 years of progress. So, but there you have, we hear so much of the disasters of our world, we have every right every now and then to hear about the anti-disasters, the places where generosity, where vision, combined with extreme good sense, made the critical difference between disorder and hope, and Kenya is certainly one of them. Now, I take those examples because they're from countries which, in a sense, we had no right to suppose would be doing as well as they do. And I would thoroughly support your president when he says that India is a land of hope, because underneath the sorting out of the politics of 500 million people, and that's quite a lot of people to sort out, underneath the turmoil of a system that is open and plural, and therefore has its political problems in the open, there is, at the grassroots level, a potential agricultural revolution which will transform Indian society over the next 15 years. but it will transform it, I think, only under one condition. And now I come back to the point I made earlier, and that is these changes are not, in fact, going to occur unless we recognize that they do demand an immense amount of capital and an immense amount of trained brain power. In other words, these changes, which can be made, of which there are examples now all around the world, do depend nonetheless upon very sizable inputs of capital and a really sustained strategy of development to see them through. Because without that, you will not get that movement towards technical change and modernization. You will not get rising incomes which make people productive enough to in fact buy for their food needs. You will not modernize the farms. And until you modernize the farms, you will not in fact get any control ultimately of the growth of population. Because population control goes with rising standards and with rising education. There are some shortcuts, no doubt, but basically it is a community decision, and it is a decision based upon hope for the children. Now, have we any idea of the orders of magnitude of what this capital input should be? Well, it's bound to be a little bit general, of course, because they are forecasts into the future, which always have an element of doubt. But at least the president's scientific advisers, who are as objective and skilled a body as men as you can find in the world, have made some calculations of what would be necessary up to 1980 to get this kind of transformation of the developing country's agriculture to bring about this 6- to 10-fold increase which technology does make possible. And their estimates run roughly like this. On the enormous increase in irrigation potential, both through dams, through small dams, through electrification, and through tube wells and pumps, $80 billion should be spent as a world figure by the mid-1980s. The next area is fertilizer, improved seed, pesticide, and appropriate farm machinery. And for that, they reckon another $21 billion. Then there is an estimate which is much more vague because it involves calculations which are not easily put into money terms. For instance, the labor that you can use when you have rural underemployment to build banks, to level fields, to put in support roads, and so on. And this whole question of the farm-to-market road, which the Kenyans put in advance, is critical. In Denmark, for every square mile of land, you've got 3 miles of farm-to-market road. In India, the figure is not much over 0.5 of a mile. And that gap is the gap between getting the stuff to market or not getting it there. Therefore, it's critical. The only trouble about putting a monetary price on this is that in countries like East Pakistan, an enormous amount of this work has been done as part of rural works virtually in return for being fed rather than being paid. Therefore, if one arbitrarily adds another $21 billion for all the works, the sort of infrastructure apart from irrigation, it may or may not be an accurate estimate, but it's the only one we've got. That would suggest that by the middle of the 1980s, we've got to envisage something like $120 billion worth of investment. Now, I know that sounds an awful lot, but remember, it's what this poor, crazy, lunatic old world spends every year on armaments. And there's a lot to show for that, by God. So don't let us think out of proportion of this figure. 120 billions is, in fact, what we throw away in the works of death. And this is really only 120 billion over, in fact, before 1980, which would work out at $10 to $12 billion extra over and above what we do now in development. What would that mean to us in the Western world as a community if we accepted that this strategy was a high priority for the future of the human race? Well, we've got to remember that between 70 and 80% of all the investment done in the developing world today is done by the developing peoples themselves. I think we forget how much of the growth that is going on in the developing world is done by local saving out of very inadequate incomes, but it is achieved nonetheless. The fact that in the last 15 years, Latin America, Africa, and Asia have contrived on the average to grow by rather more than 4.5% a year is a very considerable achievement. And only 20 to 25% of the investment that has made this growth possible has in fact been provided from the outside world, and probably only half of that on what you might call concessionary or aid terms. Therefore, we should not feel that we alone, single-handed, have brought about what growth there is. We have been responsible for a very essential element, which, owing to the bias in world trade, it's very difficult for the developing nations to get their hands on, and that is the critical component of foreign exchange. And that component, if we go on the same analogy, on the same distribution, if you like, of responsibility as has existed hitherto, probably what we would be asked to put in over and above this flow of economic assistance at present available is $4 to $6 billion a year. That would be for the critical inputs in the agricultural revolution. And if we did that on concessionary terms, it would begin to bring up our economic assistance to about 0.8 to 1% of national income. Because we have to remember that all the time during these 15 years, the Atlantic community as a whole has never grown by less than between $40,000 and $50,000 a year. In other words, now that our combined national income, and what's one to do with all these noughts? How is one to make people feel just exactly what the scale of wealth is? Let me give you some comparisons. The United States economy grows each year by virtually twice the entire national income of India, twice the national income of Africa. The entire national income of your Latin American sisters is between $60,000 and $70,000. 1 year's annual increase in American wealth is of the order of $40,000 to $50,000 million. In other words, if you take the Western world as a whole, we grow each year by about the equivalent of the entire national incomes of the developing world. That is the scale of resource distribution between us. But in spite of that, on their critical fields of investment, it's still they who provide 75% and we only 25%. So let us keep some of these figures in balance. Another one that is possibly interesting and worth quoting is that if you take the combined bill of the English and French-speaking members of the Atlantic world on drink and tobacco, and don't get me wrong, I'm in favor of both, it is $50,000 million a year. In other words, we spend, we, the English and French speakers, not adding German beer, my friends, just the English and the French, nor the Scandinavians, no, just the English and the French, we spend on drink and tobacco each year more than the entire national income of India. Well, you know, it makes me think, and I'm sure it makes the cherubim think, and I'm sure that these balances are part of the essential drama of our time, and that we are confronted here with facts which, if we do not know, we have to know if we are going, in fact, to look at our world as it really is. So when I say that we have to add, in order to get this agricultural change, we have to add possibly $4 billion a year as an entire Atlantic community in order to get up to that level of investment which will make the modernization of agriculture reasonably secure, I in fact suggest something which our national incomes gain in 1 month. Gain, an add. Therefore, to call this sacrifice is possibly a slight stretching of our language. Having said that, I would also say that these are times in which to envisage this goes against the political temper of our day. At this moment, for a whole variety of reasons, the Atlantic economy is not handling itself with major wisdom. We've just been through a monetary crisis, in part inspired by a peasant mentality that likes to bite its currency and put it under the mattress, which is no way to run a modern economy, in part by thousands upon thousands of speculators and hoarders who represent, shall we say, the least attractive form of economic activity that the human race can indulge in, because if that is not something for nothing, I do not know what is. But we are, in fact, living through times when, under pressure of war, under pressure of monetary crises, under pressure of a disequilibrium which we are not solving wisely, we are, in fact, in a year when even the rate of economic assistance that we give now is under pressure and could even in this country disappear. Okay, 1 year. A year of great difficulty. And that I don't doubt. Nor do I believe that it is possible in a year like this, election year, year of pressure, year of monetary crisis. I do not believe it is possible in a year like this to do more than cling desperately to what we've got, which is about $5 to $6 billion worth of assistance being transferred to development programs, and therefore very far short of the figure needed for this agricultural revolution. But are we creatures of only 1 year? Are we so unable to think about our future that because we are in a difficult position this year, we're going to scrap the whole idea of a development strategy for the future? Are we, as intelligent citizens of the Atlantic world, going to say it's going to be less next year and next year and next year and the year after? And even however much we may grow over the next 10 years, none of this is going to be for the essential modernization of the agriculture of the world. Are we going to say that we have no perspectives more than 1 year for our world community? Are we going to live in a world round which you can stroll in 90 minutes and one which you can blow up, presumably, in 90 seconds, and be unable to have creative thoughts for the 70s as they come towards us? Surely this is an abdication of every kind of wisdom that we apply in every aspect of our lives. We do not live like the grasshopper. We try to live, surely, in our national and our domestic affairs so that we have some concept of how our life is going to turn out. We have some idea of where we're going and what we're trying to do. And what I'm suggesting to you now is that as citizens, when we look beyond this difficult year and determine that it will not be followed by years at least of the same kind of difficulty, that what we are saying is we can be a community which grows each year by not less than $40,000 to $50,000. Some of that will no doubt go to our higher standards of living. We may even push that splendid figure for drink up to $100,000 million. Why not? I mean, you know, $100 million a year. What am I getting? Yes. $50,000 million, $100,000 million. By God, it is $100,000 million. Yeah. Well, maybe this is where we're going to push it. We could afford to. I don't know what the consequences would be, but we could afford to. Or are we going to say something else as communities? Are we going to say that among those priorities which we propose to ourselves and propose to our governments is that by the 1980s, the great hunger will have been conquered? You're farmers. You know it takes a bit of time to work out the strategy for a farm. You know that it's taken this country something like 50 years to get to the levels of productivity where you are now. You know that when the people put in the land grant colleges, they didn't expect to get a total generation of farmers the next day. They planned for the future. And what I think we would ask above all of those citizens who by their activities are kept close to this sense of the longer processes of our great economy and of our land itself, that they should demand the same kind of sagacity and the same kind of direction and the same kind of inputs that we accept in our national life. And that maybe the great contribution which can be made by farmers as citizens is to say, we accept the idea of a strategy for the modernization of world agriculture. We ask you to tell us soberly, factually, what that will be. And we ask that the future growth in our wealth shall in some measure be directed towards it. Because we cannot look our children in the eyes if we say, sorry, we used up all that particular bonus on another swimming pool, on the third car, on another house, a beach house perhaps. Or we simply allow that upward drift of standards of living, which always mean that as you move up the ladder of your income, the law that Parkinson did not in fact formulate, which was that needs rise to fill the income that is thought to be available. Now, under that upward drift, which is the great challenge to the conscience of the well-to-do, are we going to break it and put in another drift, another picture, another line of development, which is that we do not want to carry on our own foreheads or on those of our children what would be the mark of Cain. If by 1980, all around the world, children are dying because of the investments we didn't make in the 70s. because that is ultimately the stark challenge. Children will die because we've decided to do nothing. And it seems to me that here, a farming community, with your ideal of the cooperative venture that can work for the good of mankind, that you perhaps have a special responsibility to act as a citizen vanguard, to beat up your members of Congress, to go after your senators, and to say, we want a strategy so that the world can be fed. We regard this as one of the prime responsibilities of our political system, and we are not content for you to say, over the next 15 years, that it cannot be afforded. We know it can. We're not asking it perhaps this year of great difficulty, but we expect over the next 15 years that this job will be done. And we demand a commitment, and we demand a strategy, and we demand a dedication. And I don't know what you feel, but I myself think that this goes much further even than feeding the hungry, though heaven knows it's very difficult to go further than that. I think it goes to something much deeper, and it's this. We are the first communities in history to be rich enough to choose. And I think that much of the unrest all through our world among our children is the sense they have that we are not choosing, that we're merely opting for this upward drift of prosperity, and not for purpose, not for dedication, not for any sense of what our countries mean and of what our society can do. And so behind the specific task of the modernization of world agriculture, which we know we can do if we put our minds to it, there is the much deeper problem, what sort of a community are we? What sort of claims do we make for our Western way of life? Above all, what do we say as Christian people we stand for when we look only 12 years ahead and see the children undernourished, hungry, hopeless, who have been condemned to this by us, the children of Cain? That, I think, is the challenge, the most ultimate challenge that can face us, the use of our wealth so that man may choose life and not death. Thank you.
Lady Jackson. You have done all of us in Midland a great honor by being with us. And I think the response of the audience indicated just how they feel, and anything I might say could add nothing to it. I would, however, like all of you to know that Lady Jackson extended herself terribly to be with us here this evening. She was in a board meeting in Chicago until late this afternoon. She will be speaking at lunch in Pittsburgh tomorrow. She will be leaving for London, I believe, tomorrow night. And she has done us the great honor of coming here to be with us this evening. Lady Jackson, we thank you very much.